Before we begin, I would like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teachings and work at Del Seton Medical Center. Any discussions we have on this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and in no way connected to Del Seton Medical Center. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. My name is Lucas Ferrer.
And Miguel Montero Baker here.
And today we had the pleasure to have Pedro Teixeira. He's the Chief of Vascular Surgery at UT Health and my boss. And today we'll talk about his serendipitous journey from Brazil to Austin and how he became the leader of vascular surgery at the institution and all the fun he had along the way. So
very, very cool story. Yeah.
Yeah. Without further ado, here we go. Let's go.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Life of Flow. Today, I have the great pleasure of inviting somebody that, you know, has been very influential, is influential in my day-to-day life. Dr. Pedro Teixeira. He is the division chief here in Austin, Texas at UT Del. And we're just going to have a kind of probably a very wide ranging conversation, Pedro. You have a great story and I'll let you go into it. But I think, you know, how you've come to guide this really exciting project that is the, I would say, it isn't just the division of vascular surgery. Or vascular surgery as a project, but it's wider than that. I'm just very curious and interested on how you're actively guiding and informing yourself and going through this process. So without any ado, welcome, Pedro.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
So Pedro, maybe for the people that don't know you or don't know of you, how about we start with a brief summary of where you're from, what was your career path, how'd you end up doing trauma, and then followed with vascular surgery, and how'd you end up here in Austin?
Yeah, that's a, I don't know if I can make it brief. It's quite a discombobulated story. You know, I'm originally from Brazil. I was born and raised in Brazil.
What part of Brazil?
I'm from Belo Horizonte, which is one of the capitals in the southeast, in the state of Minas Gerais. So I was born and raised. Never thought about coming to the United States, did medical school, became a surgeon, did my training there. Trauma was my passion, right? And a big city in South America, violence, unfortunately, is something that we see every day. I did my training and ended up working in the largest trauma hospital in the city. And that was my passion. That was what I really wanted to do and perfect. And that's what I really wanted to be good at.
So at the time, were you particularly enamored to vascular trauma?
At the time, not really.
Not really.
Because vascular trauma was part of trauma as everything else.
You wouldn't call the vascular surgeon.
We wouldn't call the vascular surgeon. We did have vascular surgeons that worked with us, but it's a very busy hospital. We had five faculty staff on call every night and a vascular surgeon in-house. So six surgeons in the hospital. Six attending surgeons in the hospital.
How big was this hospital?
It's a super large hospital, but the thing is the catchment area is about 2.5 million people. And then at the time, every single injured patient would come to this place. They sometimes would, patients would go to smaller hospitals, but at the end of their path, either acutely or in a subacute fashion, the patients would end up with us. So very, very, very busy. So trauma was my thing, and that was my passion. That's why I became interested in coming to the United States, which for me, the U.S., the medicine in the United States was this thing that you read in the textbooks, and many things you even read and say, that, I don't think they do it this way, because it's so away from the reality we had that it's okay. Do they really do it this way? And then I had an opportunity to come to Los Angeles to do a...
You were an attending?
I was an attending surgeon.
How many years out?
I was 2 years out and had an opportunity to come to do a year of research. So that was a very... So Dr. Dimitriadis, which is one of the biggest names in trauma surgery in the world, came to the American College of Surgeons, to the Brazilian College of Surgeons conference. And he ended up meeting one of my professors from medical school, put us together. She talked to him and said, I know this guy that would probably have interested in working with you for a while. So I said, yeah, let's get together, talk about it. I reached out to Dr. Mitradis.
Were you married at the time?
I was already married, but did not have kids.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was married, did not have kids. So how the old? Plan, I was 27.
It's always hard.
27. I was 27 years old. So the plan was to come here and do 1 year of trauma research to like really get better academically, to have some experience. I wouldn't be able to practice because for those who don't know, if you're not trained in the United States, you come here, you cannot have any meaningful clinical activity. So the goal was really to do research, to get exposure to the trauma system in the United States and go back. And that all changed because there was a lot of excitement from my part, seeing what is done here, what can be done here, seeing how there's no limit to a lot of things. If you want to do good work, there's a lot of infrastructure for you to be able to accomplish things. So my initial thought was, I really want to do some clinical work in the United States. And then because the system would not allow at that time board certification if I didn't do formal residency training, my decision at the point was, okay, let me do residency again. So that's what I did. I decided to do residency again, general surgery, match at USC, which is the place where I was doing my research. I started doing the residency, but I
did
still...
Did you get a categorical position?
I did get a categorical position.
That's pretty nice.
That's pretty nice.
Well,
that's pretty nice.
I did a terrific job.
Well, I did about 2.5 years of research, and at the time I already had like 40 publications. I presented everywhere. I had a lot of support from the team that I was working with, both Dr. Dimitriadis and everyone else. So that was the reason why I was able to get that position.
So for international medical graduates, we have a lot of Latin American mm-hmm. followers. When you apply to residency, there's two types of position. One is you're absolutely part of the program, and unless you screw up, you're going to finish. Or you're somehow in this temporary limbo where we have a position, we're testing you out, but we're not sure if we're going to keep you. And that's the difference between a categorical and a, what do you call the other?
Preliminary
position.
Yeah.
I was also blessed in the same way because what happened to me was the position was out of the match and it was approved. It was unfazed. Like the moment it was approved, the match had just like finished. And so they had that categorical position mm-hmm. for the first 05 floating. And I had already done vascular and I had done a fellowship in the whole nine yards, kind of like mm-hmm. you. And it was just a matter of just fat luck.
How yeah. do you like come in as an intern being like basically a full surgeon? Like you.
Oh,
you,
well, we can do a podcast just about
yes,
that.
Yes, we should. Well, we can.
I'm just going to tell you my story.
Just the experience of being fully trained.
Yeah.
It's not just being fully trained.
2 years out.
Well, yeah. So you're
yeah,
fully
let's dive
trained.
Into it because yeah, that was fun. I'll tell you my. You're I'll tell you a couple of good yeah. stories from yeah. my stage because I went into PGY1 yeah. doing HMPs in the ED. But I'll tell you my story. You have a couple.
And you
of
were
good
a trainer
ones.
For Supera,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, because it's interesting. You're fully trained in a system where, you know, I did a lot as a resident. Back home, I did a lot. So it's not just that those two, three years that I was already out in practice. My training and what the experience I had was already pretty substantial, all things considered. And now you come and become the bottom
go-getter.
Feeder.
Yeah. 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 Go getter.
It's unfortunate that the system works that way. It yeah. would be nice if the system had some flexibility to adjust to the each of the residents in a different way. Like for me, I used to think, okay, it makes sense for someone that comes from a different country to do some training, clinical training. Because the system is different. There are a lot of things that you need to adjust to. It doesn't have to be 5 years. It doesn't have to be an entire residency. You know, those first 2 years, I could have used them to learn another language. It would have been more useful for me, right? Because you're not doing meaningful work at that point that for me was making my skills better.
Yeah.
Does that inform my biggest challenge? I don't know, Pedro, but my biggest challenge was I would stand like on the weekends, like for hours reading acronyms.
Because
I was like, what the hell is ESRD?
I know.
And we'd be in rounds because also on the first year, they send you to ICU. Holy shit, I'm in the ICU rounding. And they're like, this ESRD, HT, like blah, 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 blah.
It's and same I was like, thing. In Spanish, we don't use acronyms
and
that much.
We don't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, maybe we do, but it's just not part of the medical lingo.
Yeah.
So, and then that was like the first language funny barrier, my acronyms. And then the second funny barrier was when I finally get into the OR. Like, we macerate the name of the surgical tools, like macerate them, right, in Spanish. And so we would just come up with these things that would make absolutely no sense and nobody would understand anything. And then they would say like things like skitters. I was like, what the hell is a skitter?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, sir, it's a mosquito. What the hell is a mosquito? I mean, that's an insect that flies. So that was like my two big barriers. Yeah. But again, to your point,
yeah.
I mean, that could have easily been a year, not five.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it gives you some perspective. I don't think everyone can do it. You need to have degree of humbleness. You need your ego. I mean, because if you end up in a situation where you want to prove that you're better than, no, you just need to be, okay, I am one of the residents now. Mm-hmm. I am the lowest one of the hierarchy. And it's almost like you do a self-growth program and patience.
But it makes you a particular kind of professional that becomes, and this is very interesting because I never really thought as we were diving into this conversation, it helps me understand potentially a lot of my grit and my ability to just reinvent myself multiple times, right? I had to go to Germany. I had to learn a language. I had to reinvent myself. I had to come here. I had to start from zero. I had to reinvent myself. So it doesn't matter what lemons or limes you get along the way, you become this very dynamic and very adaptable person. And I guess in this way, this serendipitous career advancement that you've had, mm-hmm. it was a walk in the park because you come from a place where you've had to start so many times that thrown into the lion's cage with this new thing, you're like, okay, I guess I'll have to learn some new things and adapt to this whole thing. But it does make you a very special person.
Yeah. And then it also shows you that a lot of the roles that people have in a group, like in a work team, they're not necessarily tied to the titles they have. Right. So, for example, let's say we are on trauma call and I'm an intern on trauma call. And then we have a second year, third year, a chief and an attending. But at the time, I had the same degree of experience that one of the attendings. Right. So the role that I had to do and the meaning for the team of having an intern that had the experience of an attending. So puts the team in a very good position. Right. It doesn't matter what the titles are of those individuals. And I kind of bring this thing to my daily life. It doesn't really matter what titles people carry. What really matters is what they can do for the team. I think that's very important.
The hardest thing there, Pedro, that I've noticed in leadership positions is you believe that, but the people around you are potentially expecting that title. And so your biggest accomplishment as a chief is understanding what the definition of success for you is for everybody in the team, because you need them to do a specific task. Mm-hmm. But you also need to know what Lucas's definition of success is and understand it through his scope so that you can make him be happy. And he's also making the chore that somehow you need him to do for the bigger group.
Yeah. And that's very important. And it's also important when you are in the phase of bringing people to the team, you need to make sure that what makes them happy is aligned with the overall goal of your enterprise, right? Of whatever endeavor you're going into. Because if those things are contradictory, Lucas would never be happy.
It's not going
to
end well.
Whoever's added to the team, that their fulfillment is not aligned to the overall goal that we have as a group, it's impossible. So the selection part is very important. Find like-minded people is very critical.
Let's jump to the moment you come up with the opportunity to come to Austin, because that's a cool story. I've heard this story before.
But yeah. you do just to fast go through this fastly. But you do general surgery, you graduate.
So the thing is, I'm doing my general surgery residency, right? I'm married. My wife still wants to go back to Brazil. Okay. She still wants to go back. And now I'm in the surgery. Okay, so if I spend 5 years training general surgery and I go back home, I would still have the same degrees and the same titles. I would not have added anything.
And very
I would,
likely the same
I would basically going to go the to the salary. Same position, the same salary, nothing different. So I said, I wanted to do another specialty that really added to my trauma skills.
Still thinking of going back.
Not myself, but for my family. I didn't know if
were
my long term.
At this point?
No, I was. That? We were always very honest. Okay. So it was almost like a backup plan. So if we need to go back, what specialty will add to my skill set now that's going to be the most useful if I go back
very
home?
Very logical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very so much. I very thought hepatobiliary because the complex operations you do in trauma sometimes and you're required to do in trauma and acute care surgery, and then vascular. And then I decided to do vascular, had the opportunity to stay at USC to do my vascular fellowship. I did trauma critical care fellowship too.
But then I started residency.
I did residency, trauma critical care, and vascular.
Mm-hmm. How long did that take?
I completed everything in 7 years because I was able to do the early specialization in vascular. That was the single year that I cut off of the whole training.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
So, and then I started doing vascular. And for me, vascular was the most exciting thing about the whole experience because started doing vascular surgery, it was the first time during the training, the retraining in the US, in which I felt that I was a novice. Because now I had no experience with especially with the endovascular stuff in the past. So that was really the moment I became the vascular fellow. Okay, now I am actually doing things that I am a novice. I need to learn this. I felt the excitement about learning, getting additional skills. So I really enjoy the vascular surgery part of it. And when I finished, I wanted a job in which I would be able to do both trauma and vascular surgery.
So you weren't ready to give up trauma.
I'm never going to give up trauma. And we can dive into that story later too, because I have very, very strong personal reasons to never give up trauma, okay. Which is something that's interesting. Let's go into it. But
yeah, because
for those that don't know it,
well,
every time you scrub with a vascular attending, they say, oh, you're too talented to waste your talent in trauma. This is the thing. The vascular surgeons think that trauma surgeon is easy, that it's not a lot of surgical skills. So every vascular person that trained me, so why are you going to keep doing trauma, taking call? I mean, just it's horrible. But my plan is I will do trauma surgery until I'm strong enough to take overnight calls. I think it's very important. And it's almost like a social commitment that I have.
Okay. Because I was just going to say not necessarily somehow believing that a trauma surgeon has less quality, but I'm just talking about quality of life and the ability to have your time back and your time for your family and all these things. But this is a very ingrained commitment that means a lot to you. I mean, I love that.
Yeah.
I think so could be like very intellectually.
Do you take trauma and vascular call on the same night, or does that mean that you actually take your vascular call and add trauma call?
I take separate. I take trauma calls.
Crazy.
I take trauma calls and I take vascular calls.
It's crazy.
self-flagellating.
No, but the way I look at it, that's like awesome. From the patient perspective, right? So if you're a patient that have, let's say you have a aortic aneurysm, you can find the best surgeon that you can find. You can bad people, you can choose the surgeon that's going to take care of you.
If you have money.
even if you don't have money, you still have the opportunity to decide, oh, no, I don't want to go to this place. Of course, we have a lot of patients that have no choice, right? But even in the most basic level, you have a choice of choosing your surgeon. There is an element of choosing your surgeon. On the trauma side, there's no choice, right? You will get whoever is on call that night. And I am committed to, at least for the people that come when I'm on call, I want to be that surgeon that if they had the chance, they would choose me. Does that make sense? I want to be an asset to whoever gets injured that night and comes to our emergency room.
Does that mean, Lucas, for you guys? Because, I mean, I feel this is the super surgeon, right?
Yeah.
And if I'm in your team, Pedro, and I was working for you, and I am in a rupture AAA, or let's say something a little bit more combined. Let's say there's an aortic enteric fistula. So I know that's going to be a nightmare on, you know, the management of the intestines and this and that. I would love to have you on speed dial and be like, Pedro, I'm screwed. I have this complexity.
I have Pedro on speed dial.
And I need you to come in. Well, you know, how do you manage? Because I'm probably guessing that these guys call you before calling a general surgeon that doesn't have any vascular experience, because how good is it that he's part of your team, understands what you're doing and your complexities as he's coming to give you that backup. But that means triple, quadruple the work, because you're going, these guys are using you as their go-to guy for these complexities. Yeah, that looks very onerous on the work side.
Yeah, but that also plays into what we talked in the before we started the recording, is the importance of the vascular surgeon as supporting for a lot of, because my situation is a little bit different because I had vascular and trauma. So I add that general surgery part of it. But surgeons like us, they can be a big asset to other surgeons. Because if you think about it, in surgery, when do you get in trouble? Is when you can't get control of bleeding, is when you can't isolate a complex vessel. Those are the times that you get in trouble in any surgical specialty. So surgeons that have this background, they can become a significant asset in the institution. That plays really well into how you build your reputation as a surgeon that is there helping everyone else, right? And that goes to the leadership part of it. Because if you become recognized as someone that your role is very important for the institution, is very important for the other surgeons, that people we're going to reach out to you to plan complex cases or to get them out of trouble, you become an asset, right? So when you, later on, you have some type of leadership role and you go to a C-suite and you are asking for resources for your team, everyone around looks at your request and they resonate.
They won't bat an eye.
Because they think, oh, okay, if I get resources for my team indirectly, everyone else is going to benefit, right? So I think this is a role from vascular surgeons, from to some extent for trauma and acute care surgeons, that it's not really taught. We don't discuss this, but I think it's very important.
So we'll probably get into this a little bit more, but we were talking to Dr. Frank Beath.
Mm-hmm.
When was it? Yesterday. And Frank is very, 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 very openly against vascular surgeons being part of the American Board of Surgery. He firmly believes that we should be an absolute independent specialty. What are your feelings, given that you are essentially the perfect transition of that? You're a mutant in many ways that has that capability. Where do you fall in that sense of, do we need this completely different board that advocates? Because to your point, vascular surgeons are not well recognized. The hospitals don't necessarily understand what we do. Our resources are sometimes scarce because we're all over the hospital. I say that we're the cleaning crew because we get called when shit hits the fan and we're fixing all these other problems. And to your point, when we eventually need some work, these other guys will support us. But why is it that we're always looking and seeking for that peer support when we, as an institution or as a complex group of individuals with a specialty, should have no necessity to go around pleading for this because we require all this thing? So what's your thoughts on the American Board of Surgery and vascular?
I worry that a complete separation, I mean, there are aspects of vascular surgery, especially if you go to the very complex endovascular work, that almost feels like it's separate from general surgery, right? It's separate. It's a completely different thing. But I'm not ready to say, oh, we need a complete divorce here.
Okay.
You know, the core of what I am is a surgeon. I am a surgeon, and I am also a vascular surgeon. I don't think, at least in my case, for everyone that's practicing exclusively vascular surgery, I think there's still something to be said of belonging to this bigger thing, which is surgery.
Okay.
And that is, it's true for a lot of surgical specialties. I think the problem that we have here regarding a lack of recognition for this role, this supporting role, very critical that vascular surgeons perform, is the way the system works. The incentives in the system do not recognize this role that we play, right? There is no CPT code for coming in and saving the day, right?
Yeah.
Which is sometimes it would be very important. And the way reimbursement is, the way the money moves around, the way the resources are assigned is not necessarily, the system is not necessarily ready to recognize this important role. There, we should, if we start to discuss, like, so advocacy, so what can we do to make the vascular surgeon's value more recognized? It's probably something in the system that we need to fight for so that this is recognized, objectively recognized. For example, cases that require vascular surgery that would have a different category of coding, right? You were there for the fact that you were in the case already makes the case a complex case.
Yeah. Modifier.
Modifiers, like different, like more creatively designed modifiers.
Or better backup codes. Sometimes you're just on backup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you'll spend an entire morning waiting for that call. And then they call you and they're like, no, it just came off the IVC very easy. Exactly. We don't need you.
Exactly. Yeah. A lot of the and times you're yeah. just like being available. And yeah, being right. available is not necessary. There's no monetary mm-hmm. recognition for mm-hmm. being available. It only counts if you need to really show up, right? And it's very different also if you join another specialty in the OR in a planned way is different from joining in an acute emergency situation when things are out of control. So I think the way an effective way of dealing with this problem would be to have a more significant push to recognize in a structured way something that could value our role as a supporting specialty.
We kind of went off a tangent. I want to go back to the story mm-hmm. that you told me about the parking lot. So how about you tell that story?
So yeah. So like I said, I wanted to coming out of this like long training path to be in a place where I could do trauma surgery and vascular surgery. Full practice in both specialties. I looked at very few places in the United States that I could potentially do it. So my options were very limited about regarding place I could go.
Where were those options?
I was basically looking at staying at USC or going to shock trauma. But both places, it would be either heavier on the trauma side or heavier on the vascular side. And then I called Carlos Brown. Carlos is the division chief for acute care surgery here in Austin. Carlos
How
is,
did you know him?
So Carlos, he was at USC when I first came. So during my time of research, we worked together. Carlos left USC to come here to develop the surgery residency here. He is from Austin, Texas. So I called Carlos to talk about it. I mean, he was a friend. I called him to ask his opinion. So what do you think I should do? Stay here at USC, go to shock? What should I do? And that was exactly the time when the medical school was getting approved. So the discussion became a different discussion. So why don't you consider coming here? At that point, it made no academic career pathway sense. But I said, okay, Carlos, you're a friend. Let me go check it out. So I came for an interview. And Carlos and I, at the end of the interview day, we went up to the parking lot, the roof of the parking lot. And then Carlos was pointing to the surrounding holes on the ground, literally saying, okay, this is where the medical school building is going to be. That's where the new hospital is going to be. So the cranes were not even there yet. It was just empty spaces. And that day, I looked around and I thought about the situation. This is University of Texas. This is Ascension, two big players in healthcare. The academic part of it is going to be exciting. I said, I'll take a chance and I'll come here. And then the way I came, I started pretty much from scratch, doing trauma, doing vascular, growing up slowly. And now we're in a much different situation.
So are you part of vascular or trauma? What division, or do you just carry a dual? Does your money, like your payment, comes from?
So my payment comes from the university.
Okay.
Right.
So I'm employed by
the university. I'm okay. Division chief in vascular, but I take my trauma calls. I'm part of the division of acute care surgery as well.
Okay. So they track your numbers on both sides, right? Mm-hmm. You get reports on what you're generating on this and what you're generating.
It gives the numbers people a lot of headaches because they have to separate what's trauma, what's vascular. So, and that's to the point of being difficult to do this in most institutions.
I was about to say, because in most institutions normally don't have insurance coverage. It's not atypical that they have no insurance coverage, and so that the hospital is, quote, eating it a lot. As opposed to vascular and a lot of the elective work that we do that has some degree of coverage, at least has Medicare coverage, right? But trauma doesn't. And so the trauma goes a lot unpaid. For sure, somebody that's doing so much work as you, I could see the headaches in trying to put together the RVUs, the performa that makes sense to still give you your leadership position and probably your appropriate salary for a leadership position.
And one of the ways that we were able to figure all these things out, this grew very organically. You know, it's because I was here from the beginning, we start adding up things. So I became part of the foundation of the whole thing. So I think that's one of the reasons why.
So how did
you grandfathered into the system?
Let's go into that process a little bit, because I was your first hire. I feel like very lucky. But during that process, you were in kind of heading the interview, and there was a position 2-4 division chief at that point. So how did that flip into somebody say, hey, you should be the division chief?
So I had been here by myself trying to grow this for a few years already. And then when we decided, okay, let's create a division, like properly add more people to the division and really proceed with the growth. Despite the fact that I had support from my chair to be the leader, I contemplated the possibility of having someone more experienced to come and join as a chief. So we actually opened a search for me to hire my chief. That didn't happen officially. We interviewed people. We selected people that I actually would love to have come to be my chief. And strategically, the reason why I did that is, one, because I didn't really feel that I needed the title. That was not something I really was passionate about. That was not really important to me. What I really wanted is to have the ability to grow the division. And in many ways, bringing someone with a bigger national name, a bigger caliber in the vascular environment, especially because me being trauma and vascular, I'm always a little split. It's very difficult to grow in one of those two environments. So I really thought that, okay, bring someone at that level would make sense. And then COVID happened. Things got, the time frames got extended a little bit, and we kept going. You joined the team. And then it got to a point where even one of the people that were interviewing for the chief position told me, why are you doing this? You were making this thing happen. You don't need to bring anyone else to fulfill that role. You should just do it. And then I talked to Kevin, and who's our chair, and we decided to, okay, so maybe we do it. And then the way we did it, actually, I went through an interview process. So we did the same pathway of the search that we had for the people that were coming in to interview for the position. I went through the same thing. I had a vision presentation in which I put everything together. I gave that vision presentation to the leadership team of the university and Ascension. And then we decided to go that way.
What was that vision then, and what is the vision now?
So the overarching theme of that vision is the transformation of vascular care in Austin from a very transactional relationship between surgeons and healthcare systems and providers, which function a lot as a community setting, and how we bring them this situation to an academic, like real top vascular division that can be proud of what it does. So that's the vision. It's not something that's easy to achieve, because there's a history here of how things have been done, and relationships locally. It's not easy. So the process needs to be very gradual and very, very careful. So
Lucas asked if the vision has changed. Do you remain aligned with that core vision that you had, or is that something that today you think you've shaped into something maybe different?
Well, the vision is the same. So so the way I look at this whole situation is, if I am a patient with a vascular problem that I'm going to be cared for in this area, what do I think would be the best way for me to be treated? That shapes what we are trying to build. And it's interesting. A significant part of the vision is related to how we work with the other specialties and how we work with different people. And a good example is, so when I was the only person, I mean, I was the division of one, my partner was one of the cardiologists, Peter Montleon. He came right after I came. And Peter and I did cases together. We still do. We bounce back cases between the two of us. We discuss challenging things. He has a particular interest about peripheral arterial disease. And that relationship was great and is great. And the mindset still the same. So every person that come in and joins the team now, one of the first things I ask, so how are you going to play with everyone else, not just the surgeons in the team? How are you going to play with the vascular technologists? How are you going to play with the cardiologists? How are you going to play with the interventional radiologists? Because that collaboration, it's very easy for us to say, oh, this is a multidisciplinary thing. That word is being so overused. Multidisciplinary is thrown around a lot, yeah. Around a lot, mm-hmm. And has no value behind it most of the times. But more than the multidisciplinary things, this interpersonal relationship across specialties that makes work every day fun, and that allows patients to receive skills that come from different professional backgrounds, I think is critical.
I'm curious, those people that you would have loved taking the chief position when you were looking, what was the main reason they turned the position down, in your opinion, if they shared?
It was not just turning the position down. It was there were at least two. I can cite one.
Okay.
One is Vincent Rowe.
Okay.
One person is Vincent Rowe. Vince was my program director. Vince is a phenomenal guy. I have the utmost respect for him. Mm-hmm. And one, I wanted Vince to become chief.
Okay.
And I wanted him to be my chief here. And for the discussion with Vince at the time was exactly that. I mean, he came, he interviewed, he was interested. I was interested. Everyone was interested. And then COVID hit. And then there was a pause.
Okay.
And that pause created a gap that change things a little bit. And he was the one that at some point in this discussion, why don't you just do it?
Got it. So were it not for COVID, you think he'd be the chief today?
I can't say he would, but I think that would have been a good chance that Vince Rowe would be the chief instead of me.
Okay.
Yes. For now, sure. And today, now he's at UCLA. So
now to the, yeah, I know. He was shopping around for a while.
Yeah.
Vince and I have a good relationship.
Yeah,
and
he's
we butt heads a lot. And yeah, he picks on me for being very endo enthusiast. Yeah. But
he picks on me for being very endo enthusiast.
There you go. It's easy. The roles keep perpetuating. Exactly. So now, probably feeling much more comfortable in your role. Do you think there is a need for you to continue searching at some point, or at this point, do you feel that the chief of vascular surgery is here and here to stay?
I mean, I'm here to stay. I'm not going anywhere, right? I'm not going anywhere. I am not, I stick to the vision. I think we're in a path for success. I think the growth that we're experiencing is very exciting. And right now, I'm in a different situation. I would love to have people with significant national experience, national reputation. I really worry that some of these people could change the path in a worse way.
Okay.
You know, so we are being extra careful when we're considering people to join the team. And I'm not even thinking, okay, who's going to be the chief? We have a very, very nice relationship. We try to, in the team, allow people to do the things that they love, flourish in what they are really good at, become better on what they're not as good at. But the growth needs to be for all of us. It has to be good for all of us.
Can you talk about that? Can you talk about culture? Because one of the things that, you know, keeps me here is culture. I'm very happy when I walk into work. I'm very happy when I work with the residents, with the staff, with our group. And that's not easy. That's not
and
easy.
And as you answer it, because for me, it's, I don't know the system, but is it surgery culture kind of widespread, or is it in your micro atmosphere of vascular surgery that the culture is very benign?
It's widespread, but I think you do very purposeful in the way that you perpetuate and expand it. Is there a process? Is this natural? Is this something that you are hyper focused on? Can you expand on that?
A lot of it, I think, may all even be non-intentional. It's just the fact. So when we talk about this leadership, there are two ways of doing it. It's either about the leader or about the team. And I'm not throwing like leadership skills around. It's just the way I see it. And I don't think it should be about the leader. A lot of places, the structure is to go up a pyramid and then it has to benefit the top. And I honestly don't believe that that's the best way to do it. Because even if I were successful in that model, being at the top, I don't think I would be fulfilled by that experience.
How so?
It's just not what I want. You know, I would rather have people that are closer to me that will be able to discuss things more openly. There, I don't want 20 degrees of separation between the position that I occupy to the position that everyone else in the team occupies. I think the proximity that we have is great, and I think the ability that all of you guys have to come and tell me things that I'm not doing right is great. I actually like that, and I think nurturing that culture is important to me, very important to me. I would hate if we brought someone that screwed this thing up. So that's why we're being very, very careful in the selection.
When you decide to take this position, and throughout the last couple of years that you've been developing it, have you purposely done anything in the sense of self-improvement? Not the automatic day by day that you're learning, but have you taken courses or have you read books that you think are worth our listeners? Have you worked with a coach? Have you done any of these things? And if so, would you care to share some of these assets that maybe somebody in the process of taking a leadership position should definitely consider doing? Yeah.
I think the formal training is very important. I did the postgraduate Harvard course, the surgical leadership course, which is a one-year executive program. I did that. I think it was very, very useful. I'm reading more about it.
What's your favorite book about it?
So it's not necessarily about the classic leadership, but I recently read one that I'm telling everyone to read. It's called 4,000 Weeks. You know what 4,000 weeks is?
No.
It's the duration of our life.
Oh boy.
Oh really?
So when you look at 4,000 weeks this way, it's very short.
Yeah.
It's very short. So a lot of what the book goes.
And this is a book by Oliver Berkman.
Berkman, yeah.
4,000 Weeks.
Yeah. I did the audiobook, the author.
Because we put these references in our podcast.
The author is the one that talks on the audiobook. And a lot of it is how you prioritize things, what projects, because we have this tendency of having like two very important projects, several less important, and some that are not important at all, but you never get them out of the queue, and they're always creating this mindset nice. That you always. So a lot of it is just, okay, you have this small amount of time to be successful, to do the things you want to do, to accomplish things you want to accomplish. We need to shed some of these responsibilities and some of these things and just let go of a lot of things, which is something I always had a problem with.
I think don't
let go. You become a hoarder of unfinished projects just because you don't want to say no. A lot of people come to you, you like do this. Yeah, you say yes, 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 yes. But then there are a lot of things that are not adding to your satisfaction, is not helping your team.
Yep.
No one cares about it. And you just create this environment. But going back to the training, I think the training is important. Formal training teaches you a language. You know, there is a language of the business world, of the finances, understanding how money moves around, understanding what's important for a company when they look at the bottom line. I think that is critical. You have to do some formal.
What would you recommend that formal training be? Having gone through it.
I think so. When I did this executive course, the surgical leadership program, if you look at the curriculum, it matches the curriculum of an MBA. It's just more streamlined and directed to a surgeon that's in that position. For me, it was great. So before I signed up for it, I reached out to the leadership at the program, and I asked them. So because I was thinking about doing an MBA, and you know, the discussion was what they told me is, if you need a title or promotion, do an MBA. If you don't need the title, these more objectively created courses for what you need is probably all you need. Because you go through quality issues, you go through finances, you go through like regulations, you learn a lot of these things. And when you go to the C-suite, you need to understand what they're talking about. Because, I mean, most of the times they put the spreadsheets, and if you don't know what's happening there. You don't know what's happening there. So actually, the biggest thing I think I learned when I did my training, I understood how the physician is seen within the organization. When you have a spreadsheet, the physician sits on the expense column. You are an expense. And that was, for me, when I heard this, it was eye-opening. Because in many ways, it would be better if we were treated like a CAT scan as a physician. Because the CAT scan machine is an asset. Which means the institution. But it's true.
It's a revenue generating asset.
The institution has to invest in maintenance for that CAT scan because you want to maximize the life of during which that machine is going to be doing work. You have to do the maintenance. And then you take into account the depreciation and you want to use it for as long as possible at the top of the capacity. For the physicians, different. They treat the institution treats the physician as something that could go away because they don't own the physician. They treat the physician as something that could go away. So you can, there's no this mentality of how can we invest in the physician as an asset to prolong the life of work that can be generated through that experience. It was fascinating. So unfortunately, physicians are in the expense column.
Is there something that you had to, is there some growth, some personal growth that you had to, and then we'll kind of end there. Some personal growth that you had to go through to kind of be the best at this position. Is there something that you had to just improve from for yourself as a human?
Your hardest mountain that you climb, that you needed to climb personally to get to this position and own it, in other words, maybe?
For me, having difficult conversation is not easy. You know, having to tell someone that they're not doing the right thing is very hard, very hard. So those conversations have always been something that I try to, avoid, postpone, pretend it's not happening. So this is an area that I had to work very hard. I have an easy time being introspective about how my shortcomings, which sometimes becomes a weakness. So if you always think you're not good enough, can be powerful, but can always also be a weakness, right? If you're always think you're not good enough, means that you are reactive to it. You're always going to be trying to improve. But it can also cripple you, right? If you don't think you're good enough, you may not take responsibilities that, you know, you could no problem take. So, yeah.
So I want to be respectful of your time. We invited you to share for 60 minutes. I love that you came. I mean, of course, we're in Austin, makes it a little easier. But I love that you came in person. Lucas has essentially brought the entire team to talk to us. We had Demetrios before, and it's been great. Before we leave, how easy or how incredibly hard has it been to work with Dr. Ferrer?
So, I mean, this is my first hire. he's gone through a lot of the pains, right? So when I offered him the job, it was a much different job from what I'm going to offer to the next person, right? We joke about it. Every time we bring someone here, a lot of the answers to the candidate's question is going to be, I don't know. Some of the questions are going to be, oh, you will have to figure that out. So that's going to be your responsibility doing it. When Lucas joined, most of the answers were that way.
Got it.
Very few points were, we know exactly how it's going to be. I didn't even know where he was going to do clinic, so a lot of things were completely open. And Lucas accepted that as a challenge. He's grown into a significant role in the division. The residents love him. And when I look him interacting with the residents, I get a kick out of it. I love it. I really do.
Well, Lucas is a special guy as a mentor, as a friend. I've also enjoyed having him around despite some of his sociopathic inclinations in many ways. I will say this, Pedro, every time I talk to him about some professional aspect, he is incredibly content. And a lot of those things gravitate to having leadership that's appropriate. And I think he's very happy working under you and with you. And so I think you're building a phenomenal team. I give kudos to you, to the institution, for believing in you. I do agree with you. You don't need anybody, man. You got this. And you guys are building it. It's cool to go into a cushion position.
And let me make this opportunity to plug. We are hiring. We are actively hiring. We have four positions open.
Four?
We have four positions opening.
Well, for all of you out there interested.
For Vaskers. And the interesting thing about the way we do this thing, it's a very flexible way to create a job for a special person, right? So the goal with our search is to find special people, people that are good, that are talented, that are open-minded, that want to work in a good environment. And then together, we're going to carve a spot in the system for them to be able to do the things that they like.
So for all you unicorns out there, there are amazing jobs and opportunities here in Austin. We'll put the link for the job positions also, if there's people interested, to make sure that they dial up and that they link up with you guys. Thank you very, very much, Pedro Teixeira, professor of surgery, trauma and vascular.